You are about to listen to a conversation between myself and Orlando Lopez, who is an immigrant to the United States from the country of Cuba. And he didn't leave Cuba just during any time, but during the rise of Fidel Castro, the communist dictator of Cuba that rose to power in 1959, approximately. It's an incredible story, one that I'm sure you're going to enjoy. Our sponsors today are Fairberry Furniture, The Coffee Steamer, Once and Again, Outworn Solutions, and Forest Edge Tree Service. Throughout this episode, you will hear five individual, unique advertisements that last 1 minute or less that are read aloud by yours truly, and I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't skip them, but listen to them, because they might be kind of entertaining, if I do say so myself, but if you skip them, that's a freedom that you have here in the United States, so, you know, do whatever you want. Additionally, if you enjoy this podcast and hearing stories like Orlando's, then I urge you to subscribe on YouTube and like us on Facebook, as well as listen on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you listen on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating if you think we deserve that, plus an honest review. And if you would like to contribute to the production of this show, which would be very much appreciated, you can absolutely become a patron on patreon.com/PaulGarcia for just $1 a month, where you will also gain exclusive access to exclusive secret episodes that will never go on YouTube or Facebook for the general public to see, only for your eyes to see for, again, as little as $1 a month. This helps a lot. And if you would like to simply donate any dollar amount to this show and you don't care about the exclusive bonus footage, then you can do so on the Venmo app. That's the Venmo app on iPhone or Android at username The Paul Garcia Show. Simple as that. Any support is so much appreciated, you have no idea. So thank you in advance for becoming a patron on Patreon, for liking and sharing, for subscribing on YouTube or liking the Facebook page. It all means a lot. And again, thank you. In this episode, Orlando and I talk about his youth growing up in Cuba before the rise of Fidel Castro, his very touching and emotional departure from Cuba when he was just a young kid, the struggles that he had to overcome coming from Cuba to the United States, such as the language barrier, knowing only Cuban Spanish and hardly any English, and much, much more, and I hope you really enjoy it. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Orlando Lopez. Hello and welcome to The Paul Garcia Show, a show about the remarkable people of Central Illinois. I'm your host, Paul Garcia, and I invite you to join me as I speak with these individuals about their stories, the lessons they've learned, and the knowledge they've gained along the way. Tune in every Sunday to witness the power of bringing each new individual's unique journey into the spotlight. Before we begin, I know that you grew up in Cuba. You're born and raised there.
That's right.
However, your father actually came over here from another country. Can you tell us kind of why and when he decided to come over to Cuba in the first place?
Yes, he came probably in his 20s, and he had an uncle that was a manager at a sugar mill. And yes, I think there were, you know, there were issues in Spain, as you probably know. I mean, there was the Spanish Civil War and of course, the World Depression and so forth. And there were so many different issues that I think affected his family. And so they decided to send him to Cuba. And Cuba was really more prosperous than a lot of places. And so there was a lot of immigration, particularly from Spain. So, yes, he went from Spain to Cuba. And then ultimately ended up marrying my mother, who was born in Cuba, in kind of the middle of Cuba. It's an area called Camagüey. But yes, that's right.
And do you know approximately, like, what year did he come over to Cuba?
You know, I think it would have been in the kind of the late 20s, maybe early 30s.
Okay, got it. And so he met your mom early on, he got married to her, and they had, how many siblings do you have?
He got married rather late. I think he was enjoying Cuba as a single man, but they were married, you know, rather late. And so they had three children. I'm the youngest of three.
Okay. And so you grew up in Cuba, born and raised in Cuba. What can you tell us about your early life before the rise of Fidel Castro? What was Cuba like? Was it a great place? Was it the slums? Was it, you know, like its neighbor Haiti is today?
Right.
What was it like growing up in Cuba?
No, I mean, Cuba before Castro was very different than the Cuba of today. You know, the Cuba of today probably has the second lowest standard of living. You know, I think Haiti might be the lowest in the in that area of the world. But back then, no, it had one of the highest standards of living in Latin America. And really, to be quite honest, almost in the early 50s, almost in the world, because there were so many people that were hurting from after World War II, you know, the Italy, Japan, and all these places that have a very high standard of living now were really hurting back then. But in any case, the more important on Cuba, the fact was that it benefited a lot from the Spanish influence, and the Spaniards were there until late in the 19th century. And then from being so close to the United States, because it's only 90 miles from Key West, so very close to the United States. And because of that, there was a very healthy economy, mm-hmm. a huge, huge middle class. And that was my family was from the middle class. But of course, back in the day before all the microwaves and air fryers or whatever that makes dryers and so forth that makes life a lot more easy today in some ways. You know, it was different back then. So, for example, my family had a maid. As a matter of fact, one time, I think they had two maids, you know, like, or a maid and a half or whatever. And so my dad was a successful salesman. He worked very hard and he was very good at it. So we had a very, very nice lifestyle. And Cuba was, to be quite honest, even today, naturally, it's like a paradise, you know, just beautiful white beaches, a pleasant climate because of all the winds, you know, that you get from the ocean and so forth. Mountain areas, very rich in agriculture. You know, they produced obviously sugar, coffee, tobacco, you know, mm-hmm. Cuban cigars. I mean, that was the thing, you know, even Kennedy after he started the embargo against Cuba. He wanted to make sure he had enough Cuban cigars in his stash to maintain. Mm-hmm. But again, so my lifestyle was very comfortable. I had very loving parents and went to a private Catholic school. And we belonged to the beach club and life was great. You know, we didn't worry about anything. But at the same time, there was a dictator in the 50s that had taken over by a coup, and his name was Fulgencio Batista. So so because of that, there was definitely the more corruption and so forth. Even though the economy was just fantastic, you know, there was corruption and some injustices with people that were against the government, and so because of that, there were a lot of people that were not happy with the president and that government. Mm-hmm. So they did want to change.
So is it fair to say that in your day-to-day life and in your family's day-to-day life, was it relatively comfortable? However, in the government, behind the scenes, there was some corruption. Is that right?
There were issues like that. But even economically, it was very good. And really, for most of the people, you couldn't really sense that there was anything wrong. You know, so I, as a child, I had no feeling that there was anything wrong.
Mm-hmm. And so you guys could go to the grocery store whenever you wanted. Oh, I mean, was it much like American life today, you would say?
Yeah, that's a very good, yes. In many ways, absolutely, it was like American life then. You know, mm-hmm. obviously, there, you know, that was a long, long time ago. But yes, very much like a middle-class lifestyle here, mm-hmm. except that it was, you know, just, it was a gorgeous place.
And just for the people listening, to give kind of a perspective of when this was taking place, when were you born in Cuba? Because I know that Fidel Castro started kind of taking over in roughly 1959.
Right.
And how old were you then?
So in 59, I would have been seven. Excuse me. Pardon me. In 1959, I was seven. And so, I mean, I remember distinctly Castro taking over. Mm-hmm. And that would have been in January of 59. So just imagine, like, after New Year's Eve, Che Guevara and these other people that were on with Castro came into the city. And ironically, my father had, and really many Americans and a huge part of the population were against the dictator. So we were pro-Castro. And I remember the excitement of when the revolutionaries were coming into Havana after the dictator left. Mm-hmm. He took a plane with a bunch of money to Miami, and
Batista did.
Batista did. Yes, wow. Fulgencio Batista was the dictator. And my parents, who were pro Castro, I remember my mom made on a sewing machine a revolutionary flag, the July 26th flag, and draped it on our balcony. And
wow.
I mean, I was, you know, I didn't know any better. I was all excited about it too. And like that first Christmas after he took over, I wanted a uniform just like Castro had, and the little machine gun that I could, so I could, you know, pretend to be like a little Castro.
So he was obviously something of a hero then for the public.
Well, the hero part was just getting out the old guy, the dictator, and then the fact was that the Catholic Church were actually instrumental in getting his brother and Castro out of jail because they had attacked a fort and been captured. And the Archbishop of Havana and some other influential people talked Batista into letting Castro go to Mexico, and that's how he kind of gathered all these revolutionaries to go back to Cuba and start a revolution. So that's what had taken place, and you know, they promised to bring democracy back, and one of the things that Castro promised was to. And prostitution in Cuba, which, you know, was a thing with of interest to some people. And so a lot of the things that people wanted to hear. So that's why my father, you know, was kind of pro-Castro. But that changed soon, after about a year after Castro took over.
So you were talking about how the Catholic Church was instrumental in Fidel Castro not going to prison in Cuba, but rather being sent to Mexico. What was so bad about Batista? You said he was a dictator. And why was Castro and apparently his brother, what were they doing that got them in trouble in the first place? Why did they go to Mexico?
Well, the thing that Batista was doing was, first, that he took over by force. And Cuba, like many countries in the West, was a democratic country, even though it had had several dictators. So they, you know, people didn't like the fact that he had taken over by force.
How did he do that exactly?
And the reason he did that was that he couldn't have won an election. He had actually been elected in the 40s, I think it was. The timing, I'm not 100% sure, but in the early 40s, he had been president for 4 years and really did some fantastic things in terms of infrastructure, and even the constitution of the 1940s was really respected by many people, bringing things that, you know, many parts of the world didn't have, like the 40-hour work week and maternity leave and things that people loved.
They beat America to those things, didn't they? They did those before the United States.
You know, in some cases, yes, you're absolutely right. And so there were, ironically, the unions really supported Batista, even though a lot of times unions tend to be more to the left. Mm-hmm. They supported Batista. So when Castro came around, you know, it was like a tough decision. Well, who do we go to? And the unions decided, no, we're going to support Batista. So it was a divided country. And that was, you know, something that made it easy for Castro to come in.
Okay.
And so I'm sorry, the Catholic Church, the involvement was the Archbishop of Havana was the one that talked to the dictator, along with other influential people that talked him out of sending Castro, either killing or giving he and his brother 30 years in prison because it would make him a martyr. So he bought into that argument. And the reason that they were in jail was that they had, they and many others had invaded this fort and killed a bunch of people, you know, Batista soldiers and so forth. And some of them were soldiers that were in the hospital in bed, you know, mm-hmm. But there were several people that they had killed, so it was a very serious offense, and that was the reason they were in jail.
How did Batista have the power to force himself into government? Was he a former like head of the military or something?
Yeah, he was. He was a military man, and that you know, there had been a coup in the.
What is a coup?
A coup is when you overthrow the government.
Oh,
so okay. They had overthrown the government because he was involved in the military, and there had been a dictator back in the in those early times. I think his name was Machado, Gerardo Machado. And so they had overthrown him and established this government, which, you know, people really liked because they hated the prior guy. And that's the ironic thing. You know, that's what happened with Castro. Yeah. The people disliked Batista, but then Castro ended up becoming worse than the problem that we had before.
Castro had a big following, your father included. And as him and his brother were trying to overthrow Batista, they captured them, and it was the Catholic Church, some archbishops, I suppose, that said, maybe don't imprison these guys or kill these guys because they'll go down as martyrs. Because look, the people love them. So right. If you do something bad to them, you're just going to have a motivated army coming right. after you. So instead, that's when he sent them.
You're going to make it worse, yes.
Right. So they sent them to Mexico instead.
Right, they exiled them to Mexico, and that's where they you know, put together an army, you know, a very small group of people to then go go on a boat to Cuba and start the revolution from the mountains in eastern Cuba. Wow. Ironically, this is kind of a side tangent, but ironically, one of the people that taught that group how to fight was a former Marine, U.S. Marine. And he was a Cuban that had gone to the U.S. and actually, you know, fought in the war and became a Marine and very capable guy. Mm-hmm. And he too was exiled because after Castro took over and kind of changed and really, you know, the truth came out that he was a communist, then he left. He was exiled in the United States. And he was the one that actually taught me how to drive in the U.S., ironically, this guy that taught Castro how to fight. So
he taught you how to drive a car?
How to drive. Yeah, I took driving lessons. He had a driving school, and I took lessons from this guy. Yeah, an interesting man.
Wow, heck of a side story there.
His name was Miguel Sanchez, by the way.
Miguel Sanchez. Okay, so eventually Castro, his small army, I guess you could say, they did come back to Cuba. They somehow overthrew Batista. How did they do that, if you remember? And what was that moment like? We are brought to you by Outworn Solutions in Fairbury, Illinois. We've all been there. You're trying to repair something, small or large, only to end up needing a small, little, annoying part that is specific to the thing that you're repairing. But you don't know what the name of the part is, and you can't find it online for a reasonable price. So you start pulling your hair out, and you throw the whole project in the trash. It happens to all of us. This is precisely where the truly incredible services of Outworn Solutions in Fairbury, Illinois, come to save the day. Outworn Solutions is a 3D printing service which uses state-of-the-art 3D printing software and hardware to create any and all of those small to medium parts that you need to repair your, say, hot rod or your golf cart, your coffee machine, your action figures, your refrigerator, literally almost anything. And they do it by using a variety of strong, sturdy, or flexible filaments such as nylon, carbon fiber, PLA, granite color, copper and iron infused, or one of their many other thermoplastics. John Fares is the owner and operator of Outworn Solutions, and he doesn't only make replacement parts, but also custom creations as well, such as custom vases, frames, product mock-ups, cups and mugs, and anything else within reason that your mind can come up with. He's honestly a genius and very passionate about 3D printing. So don't search for ridiculously marked up replacement parts online or in stores. Instead, go to John at Outworn Solutions because he can create the part that you need, likely stronger and for a much better price. For the solution to all of your Outworn parts, visit Outworn Solutions at 1005 West Oak Street in Fairbury, Illinois, aka the old bowling alley, or give them a call at 815-674-9313. That's Outworn Solutions, the solution to all of your Outworn parts.
first of all, they overthrew him by getting a following in the countryside, and you know, Batista was not, you know, liked by many people for the reasons that I told you. So mm-hmm. they began to get more and more support, even to some extent from the United States, you know, because even though at some point in time, the U.S. liked Batista for many of the things that he did and mm-hmm. opening up in the trade with the U.S., they obviously thought that he was a dictator and didn't like that part. So many people in the U.S. supported, you know, in many ways, money and otherwise supported Castro. And so that's how he began to get support in Cuba from many people. And he and his brother were university educated mm-hmm. people. His father had been a wealthy landowner in the eastern Cuba, and so he had, you know, a lot of connections where people just kind of overlooked some of the things that were beginning to look not so good about who they were. For example, they were involved in a kind of a terrorist communist uprising in Bolivia in the late 40s, I think it was.
Mm.
And, wow. You know, people kind of just, you know, somehow overlooked some of those things.
Yeah. Some of the more promising things about them were definitely overshadowing, you know, the skeletons in the closet.
The skeletons in the closet. Yeah. Yeah. And just people just wanted to believe, you know, in hope and in the future. And,
right. And
he said many of the things that, you know, people love. His the soldiers that were fighting in, you know, with Castro, they, for example, would have rosaries around their neck and the beards and so
like
forth.
Like holy men.
And then people just thought, oh, these are like the apostles, you know. They did a great job of fooling the country.
Right, yeah.
Including my parents.
So they overthrew Batista. Where did he go? What happened with him? Did they execute him?
No. So Batista, you know, when they were getting very close to the capital, Batista took a plane full of money to Miami, and then later he moved to Spain. And so he left the country. And then all of a sudden, you know, a lot of the people that were involved in the government, of course, left as well. So they ended up putting these people that knew nothing about how to run a government. You know, for example, they put Che Guevara in charge of the banking system in Cuba. So the economy that was very successful before, excuse me, took a deep dive, you know, starting very soon after they took over.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like at the beginning of Castro's reign, the Cuban country, I mean, the people were excited, yourself included. What kind of things was he doing and saying that was boosting the morale and boosting his level of support by the population of Cuba?
Well, he was, I forget whether I mentioned, but he was promising, you know, democratic change. He was promising to, and Cuba had a, you know, like every country had poor people, mm-hmm. but he was promising of kind of doing away with poverty, things that people wanted, you know, were good things that people wanted to hear.
Right.
He was promising to end, you know, prostitution and all of these things, to fight crime, to
bring back education,
everything,
right?
Whatever it is that you wanted to hear, he was promising it. So it's mm-hmm. Unfortunately, then things began to go a little bit differently. And I remember my parents having discussions at the dinner table, where my mom was, you know, becoming a little suspicious of the things he was doing. Mm-hmm. He first took over the Exxon refinery.
Which is an oil rig or something?
It's an oil refinery.
Refinery.
Owned by the American corporation.
Okay.
And they took that over by force and you know, basically stole the refinery. And my mom was telling my dad, you know, that doesn't seem right, just to take over the refinery. And my dad, who was you know, by this time just into the whole thing, he would make kind of excuses why that would be. Oh, well, you know, the U.S. Government just came in and bought that and, you know, paid very little, you know, in royalties and so forth. You
so he was optimistic in trying to justify the government to justify, hoped was so good.
Yeah, why that was why that particular move was okay. Mm-hmm. And then I remember another time a little bit later that he took over this big ranch in the area where my mom had grown up. And her parents knew the people, her father in particular, knew the people that owned that ranch or big farm. And he always spoke of them as, you know, good people. And she would say to my dad, well, you know, that doesn't seem right that, you know, he took over that ranch. And, you know, and then my dad would come up with some excuse. Yeah, but, you know, that guy who was a cousin of this other president who had not been very good or this other guy who was corrupt or whatever, he would find some excuse to kind of, you know, give a retort to what my mom was saying about the people being good. But the last conversation that I remember was a man that my father knew that was a very good person that was loved by the people that worked for him, where they took over his small textile mill. And he, you know, that wasn't something he could defend because he realized that that wasn't right. And that man ultimately ended up getting killed because he was speaking out against the revolution.
The man that your dad knew personally.
My dad knew, yeah. And also the, you know, the laborers were speaking up also that, you know, that they didn't think that that was right. And so my dad, at some point in time, you know, realized, no, I made a mistake. But by then it was a little bit too late because by that time, the communist government were not allowing people to leave freely. So it was difficult for people to get out.
Why do you think they weren't letting people leave?
Well, there were several reasons. One, because, you know, of the power that they had, that they could just do that. And they wanted the labor. And there had been many, many people that left, you know, and I forget the exact number, but over 1 million people in a country that was like 7 million people left very quickly. And so it was draining the brain power. For example, doctors were leaving en masse. There were many other professionals that were leaving. So, you know, to run the different, you know, manufacturing facilities or the sugar mills or all these different things that were the heart of the country, all these people were leaving. So they wanted to stop that.
In what span of time was this all taking place? Was it over the course of years and years?
Not years and years. So he took over January 1, 1959. Then I forget when it was that Castro spoke in New York, but I think it may have been late 59, where somebody openly asked him, "Are you a communist?" And you know, you could see it in Google it or see it in the records. But he said, "No, I am not a communist." And then it wasn't a few months later where then he declared that he was a Marxist-Leninist, which is pretty much the same thing as a communist.
Right, yeah.
And so then, for example, they began to put what they called committees on every block, and food became ration. And then that committee would watch what was going on in your particular block. And they would give you the ration card, so they controlled, you know, everything. And then they took over all of the businesses. And they began to take over, you know, houses, you know, first the big houses and then going down from then, you know, first the mansions or what have you. And then, you know, having the thing, well, we're putting in a bunch of, you know, people that were poor in that, you know, kind of making a, for some people kind of explaining, oh, that's okay. They took over this big mansion and then they put a bunch of people there that were poor. But then it began to go lower and lower. And so ultimately they ended up owning everything. There was no private ownership. If you had two cars, definitely, you know, one of those was going to the government. And if you spoke out against the government, then that second car was also gone, and probably you would be in jail. And my parents became particularly concerned about my eldest brother, who had a little bit of a big mouth might be a bad way to say it, but he was outspoken, and they thought for sure he was going to get in trouble, you know, either thrown in jail or killed.
How would they, oh man, I want to ask a few questions actually. So first of all, it seems like this all happened, I mean, the military being on each block, on your block, presumably?
Well, no, not military. These were just regular people that controlled your life. So, and they, if anything was appeared to be wrong, they would call the police or the, or the military as needed. 'Cause they were monitoring everything that was going on in your block. If there were strange people. And then of course, and then of course the government, you know, owning everything, then they would tell you where you could be. So no, I mean, if you lived in this area, you could only get food in this area. And so you couldn't move around. And if there were new strange people in the block that were suspicious, then they would, you know, feed that to the authorities.
So were these basically Cuban people that became employed by the government? These basically these neighborhood watch people?
Right. Well, we were all employed by the government, but yes, there were government employed people that their job was to give out the ration cards, because all the food, even sugar, Cuba was the largest sugar producer in the world at the time. Even sugar became rationed at one point in time. Milk, wow. For example, I remember as a kid that you could not get milk, you know, and my mom, which really upset my mom. And she too was a little bit too vocal, which made my dad very nervous. But
oh my goodness,
milk was restricted to kids under two or older people over 65, and which just drove my mother nuts. And yeah, so it was a tough time, which before, you know, Cuba is such a rich agricultural problem, but then in part, you know, not having the people that knew how to do the things properly, the sugar production went way down. And then of course, then you had the American embargo that went into place after they started taking over all the American companies. Mm-hmm. And so then even everything, people would stand in line overnight waiting for, you know, the things that were coming in, for example, shampoo, toothpaste, soap, you know, just all the basics. Some of those, a lot of those were very hard to get. And people would actually stand in line outside the stores waiting for the, they had heard that something was coming in and they would be there so they could be the first in line to be sure to get some of those basics like shampoo or toothpaste.
So just like people in America will wait on Black Friday overnight at Best Buy because they're having a limited amount of the new iPhone coming out or something.
Yeah.
People were waiting on city streets or on, you know, on at the local grocery store in Cuba just right. for the chance that there might be toothpaste the next morning.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, just think of the pandemic and what we went through with, of all things, you know, toilet paper. You know, I mean, people were, you know, if you're running out of toilet paper, you're going to do whatever it needs to get that toilet paper. Mm-hmm. It's kind of that on steroids because the availability was, you know, almost nothing.
We are brought to you by Fairbury Furniture. Fairbury Furniture is the area's favorite furniture store. Their selection is huge, their staff is helpful and so friendly, and they have all of your favorite brands of mattresses, tables, chairs, recliners, couches, and basically all furniture items. So make your home comfy, stylish, and delightful when you shop at Fairbury's own beloved Fairbury Furniture. Did you ever run out of basic necessities?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And people, you know, so that's where like the black market begins to start. And I remember my parents, you know, trading things with people. You know, if you knew somebody that had chickens, then you, you know, you'd get eggs or you know, and then you'd trade eggs for something else that you needed. So that under the table exchange became, you know, very important. If you worked for a certain place that made something that you needed, then, you know, all of a sudden theft, you know, at your employer became very big. And of course, you know, they started really punishing people that would do that. But it's to even today, you know, that happens all the time. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned how your brother was outspoken. He was brave about what he said. And that made your parents nervous. Your mom was a little bit the same way, and that made your dad nervous.
Right. So my dad just, you know, who, you know, he loved us very much. And yeah, he became very nervous and, you know, had a lot of guilt about, you know, not leaving the country earlier.
Mm-hmm. And, but how would they catch people for being vocal? You said that was a risk. If you spoke out against the government, you could be captured. Or worse, I mean, who knows what's going to happen after you get captured? How would they find out? Would you literally, would me saying right now, like this government, if I was in Cuba during when you were growing up, if I said, you know, we were out eating, I don't even know if there were restaurants open, but we'll say I was maybe out in public somewhere and I said, this Cuban government's messed up. It's tyrannical. This is terrible. We all need to leave, or we need to overthrow the government. I could be imprisoned for that if the wrong person simply heard it. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, you could. You know, one of the things that probably would begin would be that they would start watching you a lot closer. And and so they would add up, you know, enough evidence that they go, no, you know, this guy is anti-government and he's, you know, influencing other people. And yeah, we need to, you know, put that guy in jail.
I just am so...
There's no freedom of speech in Cuba.
Would you say that's one of the most, I mean, if you take away the freedom of speech, the most effective way to take over a people is to probably keep them silenced and not let them talk about issues, especially issues that make the government look bad or something. Would you say that's like one of the most fundamental, absolutely crucial freedoms to have as a nation, the freedom of speech?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is. And and then add that to, you know, being able to control that, add that to the fact that so many people that probably were more of the people capable of starting something for bringing in change, most of those people left. And So freedom of speech, to me and to my parents was one of the most important things that we lost. But they took over, for example, as I was saying, the Archbishop was so involved in getting Castro out of jail and kind of, you know, saving the revolution, unintentionally. Then soon after, then the churches were closed and the Catholic school that I went to, all the priests or the brothers, you know, were forced to leave the country. So then all of a sudden the teachers were not really trained people. And the focus of the teachers was indoctrination. So the books, the old books were taken out and the new ones were put in with propaganda to kind of convince you to hate the United States. And
could you give me an example of like what kind of propaganda they would have? How would they finesse that into the literature that you were reading?
Well, it might be something like, you know, in Mississippi in 1921 there were 19 blacks lynched. In 1933, there were, 10 lynched. You know, what's the difference? You know, I mean, really basic math. Or maybe
absolutely
a little bit
incredible.
Higher.
Wow.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit higher. The Americans, when they bombed, you know, dropped the atom bomb in Japan, you know, killed, you know, this many civilians. You know, when the Nazis bombed London, they killed this many civilians, you know, what's the difference? So there are things that make you think, you know, the United States is an ugly, scary country that's trying to hurt us. Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know, Cuba became so militarized where, you know, the whole concept of communism is to spread communism throughout the world. And then Cuba and Castro aligned with the Soviet Union. And for example, Cuba, then the Cuban trained military were sent to Africa and they were trying to start uprisings there against whatever the government was so that they could put communism in. And they were in the Congo, in South Africa, in many countries trying to export communism to those countries.
It's absolutely incredible. Like that math problem that you gave as an example, I've heard a woman speak who was a refugee from North Korea, and she said the exact same thing. She said that in math, they said, if there are five, and this is their words, her words exactly, there are five American bastards, and you shoot three, you kill three, how many are left?
Yeah.
That was a math question.
Yeah.
Why did Cuba hate the United States? Because they're obviously trying to say they're bad. We definitely don't want an economic system like them. We don't want anything like the United States. We want to be like us, I guess.
Right.
But why did they hate the United States?
Well, first of all, I don't think Cubans hated the United States, but then, creating that fear and dislike was a way to make sure that you know they minimized the influence of the United States so that they could stay in power and that communism could grow. Mm-hmm. And then Cuba aligning itself with the Soviet Union, then it became a military power. All of a sudden, you know, Cuba that had a population of 7 million mm-hmm. was one of the world powers in terms of army and stuff. I mean, it's ridiculous, mm-hmm. but it's just to maintain that control and that power. And then if you have somebody like the United States that could change that, then you wanted to alienate that mm-hmm. Influence so that the people were, you know, staunchly against it.
Right.
And the economy, you know, how it kept on getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Then they would say, you know, that's, even though we're doing all these great things, you know, the United States, you know, is hurting us by the embargo. And that's the reason that we don't have all these things. When in reality, Cuba traded with the rest of the world. But yes, the U.S. had an embargo against them. But, yeah. You know, they brought in, I remember as a kid seeing the new Russian cars. So they could not get any, we couldn't get any American cars. And they brought in all these Russian cars. And the Russian cars were just not very good, particularly in that kind of climate. And so you'd see all these Russian cars with their hood up, you know, steaming on the side of the road, and the, you know, 1952, you know, Ford going by. So it was ironic and sad.
One thing that I want to talk about before we move on to a really exciting part of your life here, is you said that the priests and the religious heads of the Catholic Church were, for the most part, sent out of Cuba. And I think that's worth noting that Christianity specifically, there's a lot of religions that could fit and operate under a communist government somehow, mm-hmm. Like Buddhism, for example, but Christianity and communism really don't coexist well because of the morals and the values and the principles that Christianity, Catholicism specifically, preach, and the philosophies and the principles that communism preach. They do not go together.
No.
I mean, in Catholicism, you say the ultimate leader and who we should base all our decisions off of is God. Communism, it's like you basically belong to us, the government. We are the leaders.
Right.
Is that correct, would you say?
That is correct. You know, Marx, you know, was the one, you know, one of the godfathers of communism. And he said that religion was the opium of the people. Mm. And so what they did was they just replaced the opium, if you want to look at it that extreme, with communism being like a religion. So, and then the concept was that the government belonged to the people, which is a farce. Mm. But, you know, the whole concept of communism is that, no, it's ruled now by the people and the people own everything. But really, you know, if you want to look at it, any place in communism, then let's say that, and Cuba was very different than other places that became communist, because a lot of the other places had so much poverty and such a small middle class and just this, you know, top level of people that owned, you know, 95% of the of the wealth of a country, where that was not the case in Cuba. But part of what happens is that even in those countries that were extreme, where there was too much poverty, then what happened was simply that the rest of the country became poor, was still poor. And then the shift in the power went from the rich to the communist rulers. Mm. And mm-hmm. and so in reality, there's really no benefit, not only no benefit, it's a detriment to the people themselves. Because you look at all the communist countries that now have had communisms for decades and decades and decades, they're all, you know, some of the poorest countries in the world.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so your dad's getting nervous at this point. Fidel Castro's reign is growing quickly. He's taking over him, and the government as a whole is taking over more and more. Things are getting scary. You have people on your block that are watching you. You're being rationed out food. You sometimes run out of food. Things are bad.
Yes.
What your dad says, he starts to feel guilty that you didn't leave sooner. What kind of conversations are you starting to have about leaving, and what kind of options arise for you?
Well, there were not a lot of options, but, you know, many people, as you know, left Cuba on boats, you know, small boats. Many of them perished on that 90-mile journey, because you don't go 90 miles, you know, in a small boat and survive a lot of times. There were even people that put together rafts with inner tubes to make that 90-mile journey. And so you were, most of those people were either, you know, shot by the Cuban Coast Guard, or they perished in that trip. But my parents knew somebody that knew somebody that knew somebody mm-hmm. that had a fishing boat, and they were going to pretend, the men were going to pretend to be fishing on the top, and all the kids and the women were going to be hidden below, and they were going to make a go for it.
That's the extent you were willing to go to.
Yeah, yeah. So my parents had actually, you know, put some money towards securing a place on this boat. But in the meantime, there was another option that came around, and it was called Operation Pedro Pan, which was organized by the American government, which ironically is one of the few times that so many different branches of American government have worked together for a purpose. and that was to bring out children, and they were going to do that under pretending to be a student visa. So they you know, made that, and they publicized that through the Catholic Church and the Catholic Charities, who became like the foster parents for the kids that came. And then they would find them either a foster home or put them in an orphanage until their parents hopefully were able to get out. So my parents heard about that, and they knew that we couldn't just leave out as a family on an airplane. Mm-hmm. But maybe through that process, we could get out. And so they were hoping that all three of us would leave as, you know, three brothers. My eldest brother was 18, my middle brother was 16, and I was 10. And ironically and sadly, they gave me permission to leave. I was the 10-year-old, and that was the only person that they gave permission to leave initially. So as you can imagine, as a parent, how difficult that was, you know, for both my mom and dad to have to make that decision. And they thought, you know, not only the loss of freedom, but the draft age, for example, had become 14. So there were these, you know, 14-year-olds and some even younger, you know, walking around with machine guns and
stuff.
You're
kidding me. 14 years old.
Yeah, yeah. And the indoctrination that happened in school. My parents even kept me out of school for a while, because some of the people that got turned in, because they would ask in school the teachers who were just the communists that were put in, they, hey, what do your parents talk? What kind of conversations do they have around the table? And so my parents were afraid that some of their conversations then would get, you know, them all in thrown in jail.
Oh, my
so
word.
I didn't go to school for a while, but I got permission to leave. So my mother gave me her 25 words of English that she had preparing me for the trip. And of course, I was scared and, you know, not really wanting to do that. So then she kind of convinced me by telling me things like, you know, remember that cornflakes that you can't get anymore here, or the bubble gum, or, you know, all these things that little kids like. Even the cartoons, the Bugs Bunny and Woody Woodpecker that you can't see on television anymore. You know, that's all in the United States. So, and there are people there, and they're nice people that would take you in, and then we'll be right behind you. We're coming, you know, right after, soon after that. So it won't be long. And so I was practically looking forward to the trip, you know, going from scared to looking forward to the trip.
Right.
And I remember getting on that plane to come over, and everybody was happy and so forth, and, you know, a nice goodbye. And then I get on the plane, and I'm looking through the window of the plane, and I realize my mom is just bawling.
Oh.
And, you know, all these people are starting to cry, and I got scared. I almost ran out of the airplane, but boom, the airplane door shuts, and half an hour later, I'm in Miami, and sure enough, there's this nice a lady that speaks Spanish when I got there with a bowl of candy and bubble gum, like my mom had told me. And then they sent us to this Air Force base where, you know, there are very nice people that were very kind with us. And, you know, they give us all the stuff, and I'm sleeping in these bunk beds and get up in the morning. And sure enough, there's Woody Woodpecker on the television and a bowl of cornflakes in front of me. So,
oh, wow.
So, you know, for a while there, it was just like my mom had said.
We are brought to you by the Coffee Steamer. The Coffee Steamer is Livingston County's premier coffee joint. Their trailer in Fairbury boasts delicious and decadent coffee drinks, teas, and smoothies, while their full-service cafe in Forest has all that, plus tons of incredible baked goods, sandwiches, and salads. Life is just too short to drink bad coffee, so head on over to the Coffee Steamer and start your mornings or your afternoons off right.
And then it was the decision, then what happens, you know? Well, you can't stay in the Air Force base. So this nice lady telling me, well, you know, there's a nice foster family that wants to have you, you know, move in with them here in Miami. And I'm going, no. You know, my parents are coming right out of Cuba. They're just going to be here anytime. And she said, well, you can't really stay here. You know, there are also some orphanages that, you know, around the country. And I don't remember exactly, but she mentioned one that as a kid, I knew enough about geography to go, that's cold over there. And there are probably going to be no people that speak Spanish. And then she says, and there's also one in Pueblo, Colorado, which are both Spanish words. And I thought, there've got to be Cubans there, or at least somebody that speaks Spanish. So I ended up in an orphanage in Pueblo, Colorado. And as a matter of fact, there were 56 Cuban kids that ended up in that orphanage in Colorado. It was a Catholic orphanage. And, you know, I'm very proud of the bunch. You know, we've gone to some reunions, and, you know, many, many are very successful here in the United States. One of them even became mayor of Denver, and George Bush sent him to Baghdad to put in the municipality concept there. And he wrote a book. His name is Guillermo Vidal. He wrote a book about our whole experience. So if you want to learn more about that orphanage experience, he wrote a book called Boxing for Cuba. Mm-hmm. So it gives that Pedro Pan story for him. Now, my story, his story was a little bit sadder, you know, because he talked about some sad things that I did not experience at the orphanage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, the orphanage experience was, you know, something that was scary. Particularly at first and at a couple times, but overall it's something that makes you strong, and it you know, I learned English after a couple of weeks. I was starting to communicate in English, and you know, learned all kinds of different American sports and integrated very well. So it was something that gave me strength and the thought that I could survive just about anything. And so at the end, it turned out to be a very positive thing, and I'm very grateful for the government, the U.S. government, and the Catholic Charities for what they did for mm-hmm. me and my family.
Something that the listeners might not exactly know right off the bat is that the Operation Pedro Pan that translates to Peter Pan, correct?
Right. Yeah, it's like going to the Never Never Land.
You're right. Yes.
Yeah.
And rescuing these, could say, lost boys, which is how the Peter Pan story goes.
Yeah, it's 14,000 plus kids came out under that program. And like I said, it was several branches of the U.S. government working with the Catholic Charities to find a home for these kids. Mm-hmm. Many of the parents ultimately were able to leave. My parents in particular, well, first my brothers, as I was leaving Florida to go to Colorado, my 16-year-old brother was coming into Florida, and he stayed at a camp there for the time until my parents came out. And my 18-year-old brother came out approximately over 6 months after I came out, and eventually got a sponsor to move to Denver, Colorado, and then he would go visit me at the orphanage. And of course, we were planning, we didn't think my parents might get out, and we were planning on all living together in Denver. But ultimately, 18 months after I left, my parents were able to come out of Cuba by the way, I came on an airplane, and so did my parents. You know, it wasn't like we went on a raft or anything. Mm-hmm. And my parents benefited from a program that was established after the Bay of Pigs. I don't know if you know about the Bay of Pigs invasion, but, you know, a group of about over 1,000 Cubans were trained by the U.S. To kind of, you know, start a revolution. These Cubans wanted to go back and overthrow Castro. This was in when Kennedy, well, they started training under Eisenhower, and then Kennedy took over. And yeah, they invaded Cuba in 1961. And some of the information leaked somehow. And so
like
the,
to Cuba?
To Cuba. So, you know, these, I think 1,200 invaders were met by like 25,000 Cubans at the beach. And there was a, I think Kennedy and some of the people in his administration maybe did not feel good about the fact that they didn't start this. You know, it was already started before them, and that they maybe were not getting enough information. And one of the sad things was that they kind of cut the air support that, of course, was grossly needed.
Right.
And so most of those men were either killed or captured. And so the large group that was captured, there was an exchange where Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt's wife, mm-hmm. was one of the people that helped to organize an exchange. So in exchange for medicine and some other stuff being sent to Cuba, then Castro was going to release a lot of those men and also allow some people to leave on airplanes, right? And my parents happened to just have the luck of being one of those people that were able to come out in that exchange. Oh, goodness. My parents, you could just tell how much they had aged. You know, I almost didn't recognize them in that year and a half. They had aged so much. You know, just it was so difficult. You know, I would write letters to my parents, you know, telling them, oh, I met this boy from where you were. Your parents are from, Mom. And you know, I'm learning American football and all these nice letters of, you know, fun things. I would put sticks of gum for my brothers and send the letters. Well, none of those letters ever made it. They would open the letters and toss, you know, take the gum or whatever and toss them out. But, you know, one letter where I was kind of scared because there was a guy in the orphanage, you know, a hardcore orphanage guy, not a Cuban, that he and I had an argument, and he was like 5 years older than I was, and I was just scared to death. And that's when I wrote a letter that said, you know, you lied to me. You said you were going to come right out of the country, and, you know, here it is a long time. You know, you lied to me, and, you know, I'm in trouble, and I'm going to have to run away. And, you know, just a very scary letter. I can't imagine, as a parent myself, receiving that letter. So,
and man, isn't that such a thing? So they were probably intercepting letter after letter of your nice letter, because they would read, obviously, in communist Cuba, they were definitely reading these letters to make sure what was going back home to the parents was okay. Yeah. So they're tossing all your nice letters, and on the one where you say basically you're mad at them,
that one got to them. The one where I was in trouble and hurting and sad. Yeah,
man, my goodness, and I think you told me this story in a little more in depth. It was like a kid was trying to take your money, right? Because you would get allowance at this orphanage.
Right.
And then what was it you did to him?
Well, I discouraged him with a baseball bat. And so we both got in trouble. And, you know, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, when I'm out in the playground, this guy's going to kill me. Mm-hmm. And so I really was a bit frightened. But, you know, ironically, that one guy that became the mayor of Denver, he had two older brothers, and they were like the Twin Towers. They were both like 15. Mm-hmm. And I just hung around close to them a lot more after that incident. Yeah, it was like protection.
We are brought to you by Once and Again in Pontiac and Fairbury, Illinois. Once and Again is a remarkable resale shop that sells and consigns pre-owned name brand clothing and shoes for your entire family. This year they celebrate 20 years of business serving our local community and beyond. Once and Again also has a great selection of pre-owned, authentic designer handbags without that designer price tag. Once and Again has an ever-changing inventory of name brands in their spacious locations in both Fairbury and Pontiac. Along with their tag color clearance system, shopper rewards, and other promotions, they have prices that truly will fit any budget.
Once again, it's open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And you can also shop online, too, at their website, onceandagain.com. That's once, the letter N, again.com. For more information about consignment or brands or for directions to their stores, you can again visit onceandagain.com. That's Once and Again in Pontiac and Fairbury, Illinois.
And you said that some of the information about the Bay of, it was called the Bay of
the Bay of Pigs.
Bay of Pigs invasion that was going to take place from the United States trained Cubans in Cuba. You said that got leaked to Cuba somehow in some way. And I wonder if it wasn't, you know, maybe someone was writing a letter, who knows, back home and they intercepted it.
Yeah.
I have no idea really, but yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, it is possible. And that, you know, just to put it into perspective, that happened in 61. And I was in Cuba at the time. And I remember having, you know, the majority of my people then by then were anti-Castro because that was, you know, already communism. But there were a couple of them that were kids that had been indoctrinated and they were communists.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So just imagine even your kids might, you know, be different than you because of the indoctrination. Mm-hmm. You know, there were, you know, the pioneers. If you joined the pioneers, it was not really like the Boy Scouts, but kind of like that, where they would send you off to this camp and it was, you know, like intense indoctrination. So they would kind of take you away from your parents for a few weeks and then indoctrinate you. And my those cousins had gone through that and then became hardcore communists. But bottom line, that invasion was not successful in 61. And then I came out in 1962. And then in 63 was a missile crisis, which was the closest that the U.S. ever came to a nuclear war. And so just imagine that nuclear war would have been focused on the fact that the Russians had put missiles in Cuba. And that was what the whole, issue was about, that there were all these nuclear weapons, you know, aimed at the U.S. in Cuba. So, of course, if they went to war, the first place that would be blown out of the water would have been Cuba. So as a kid thinking, you know, either way, either I'm going to die in a war or my parents are going to die in Cuba or both of us. So it was a very, very scary time for me as a child in the orphanage.
You spoke briefly about the kids that were indoctrinated that even came to the United States from Cuba that were indoctrinated by the communist teachers in Cuba. So, you know, they were kind of pro the...
No. The kids didn't come to the United States.
Okay.
No, the kids, there's a group in all the communist countries where the kids go into the pioneers, they're called. And those are like upcoming little communists, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, kind of like a fake a Boy Scout group or a boy, because girls are in the group also, you know, so... Boy Scout and Girl Scouts, but it's called the Pioneers, and they send you off to a camp where, you know, some of it is fun stuff, but a lot of it is indoctrination. Mm-hmm. And there's focused indoctrination where that was how many kids were turned almost against their parents. You know, if their parents were not communists, they were indoctrinated, and all of a sudden, you know, the kids began to question their parents, or even many cases of where they turned their parents in. And that was one of the ways. Obviously, the way to make the success, long-term success of communism is to begin with the children and change them to accept communism and question anything from the outside world. And of course, you know, make the United States the enemy number one.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask about that is, do you see, when I hear your stories and your recollection of the rise of communism in Cuba, I can't help but notice some parallels, not exactly flourishing in the United States, but at least the beginnings of some of the things that were happening in Cuba as communism was rising, happening in the United States. And I'm not saying the United States is communist by any means, but there are some rising methods or philosophies of education, I should say, namely critical race theory, that are alarming to a lot of Americans, that make us fear that we're indoctrinating our kids in a way that is not good. Like in saying that, you know, the white kids, they're guilty of, you know, they are a member of, they're part of the systemic racism against other races, other minorities and stuff. Just, you know, some alarming methods of education. And then the freedom of speech, we're definitely not getting more freedom of speech. There's a lot of agencies, organizations that try to limit what people should be allowed to say, that try to punish people for saying things that are offensive or not using the certain languages and words that they want people to use and stuff. Do you see any of the same parallels, or am I going way too far with it? Like, because I didn't grow up in Cuba, right. So maybe I'm...
No, maybe I mean, this is just an opinion. You know, I'm not an expert in that area, but I did see some scary parallels, you know, to that kind of an environment. And, you know, I think what happens is, you know, a lot of times when we have an injustice, you know, on one side, you know, you have the pendulum that's trying to, you know, swing away from that injustice. And sometimes, you know, it goes to a place where, no, it's also equally bad. And it's, you know, I mean, that's definitely what happened in Cuba after trying to get the one dictator out. We end up, you know, with a dictator that's 10 times worse. And so I think that that's something that you need to be careful with. I think, you know, I mean, I love the United States. I'm an American citizen. I truly love, I think it's the greatest country in the world. But it is scary to see that the divisiveness that seems to be taking place and the movement away from even some of the basic, not just Catholicism, but the basic principles of Christianity that were such a big part of the foundation of our country.
In the whole Western world, for that matter.
And just, yeah, I mean, really in the whole world, and so many, you know, populist type governments, and those are governments that, you know, you have somebody that tells you everything you want to hear, you know, like I was telling you, Castro did. Well, that's, you know, that's happened in, you know, in Brazil and in Mexico. Those type of governments have gone in, and then all of a sudden, you know, you just start hearing so many crazy things. I mean, I've been to all of those countries. With my work, I traveled to close to 40 countries. And no, I mean, some of the things that were great in those countries are going down the tubes also. And I am a little bit frightened in some of the changes that, you know, have gone on in the recent years in the U.S. with the divisiveness, where that was kind of the strength of our country, you know, the United States. That's how we became who we were. The immigration that built this country, you know, this country is a country of immigrants, you know, how far can anybody of us go before you have an immigrant that helped to build this country? And right. I think that was the strength, the work ethic, the hope, the dreams. That was part of what established the United States. And so that divisiveness and some of those extreme thoughts, I think it is hurting because it's stopping the dialogue that is necessary. All of the problems that we have, they're not simple problems. You know, those are problems that are complicated, that there are many, many solutions and many contributions to causing those problems. And it's, if you simplify it with one extreme solution in one area, it doesn't end up well. So it is a little bit of a concern, but I, you know, that's just an opinion. I'm not an expert in that, but that's what I believe from my life experiences and what I've seen.
One thing that you briefly mentioned that I would like to touch on is the fact that these immigrants that were with you that came from Cuba to the United States, namely the ones in your orphanage with you, a lot of them seemed to really make a great life for themselves after leaving that orphanage and after, of course, leaving Cuba. And I don't know if it's a part of the Cuban culture that the Cubans did so well, or if that's the case for a lot of, you know, immigrants that come that need to leave their country. Maybe they recognize that they get a second chance and they work so hard.
Yes.
But an incredible number of the people that you met in that orphanage from Cuba, again, did very well for themselves, yourself included in that. I was wondering if you could tell us why you think that might be the case.
Well, I think, like I said, I think almost all of the immigrants that have come here, whether it's the Italians, you know, working in the steel mills, or the Irish, or, you know, up in like Minnesota, a lot of the more Scandinavian people, you know, they came here to the Germans, you know, it's, I don't want to, the Mexicans, I don't want to exclude anybody. All of those different groups have contributed so much at a certain time because they come with a strong work ethic and a lot of dreams. And of course, my group is no different than that, the Cubans now. What I would say about the Cubans, something that maybe, you know, is an opportunity, is that Cuba, you know, for even long before Castro, was very focused on education. And that continues to be a focus. And of course, it's one of the bragging points of Castro, because he talks about the low illiterate percentage in Cuba, which is, you know, better than almost all of the world. You know, there's a very low, high literacy rate, I should say. Mm-hmm. And but that was the case also in the past. You know, obviously it's grown, but you know, that was always a focus. So education has been a strong focus of Cubans, and I think that's one of the successful things of Cubans, at least. Mm-hmm. The other is of course, you know, a good portion, particularly of the early Cubans that came, were educated people from, you know, the professional class. So that of course probably contributes a little bit to the success, but no, people that left Cuba, they were of all races. Cuba was a place where people immigrated to, so many people of all races. I know my brother has, particularly in, he lives in Miami, he has, you know, friends that were with him at that camp that I told you that he was at, that were Chinese and you know, black friends. Cuba had a, you know, a significant black population or mixed race population. It's, you know, it's something that, you know, we're proud of that integration that we had that influenced the music. We're very proud of our music. I don't know if you know too much about the Cuban music, but
dance and music, you know, is beautiful in Cuba, correct?
Dancing. Yeah. We have three people and nobody has an instrument. Somebody grabs a pan, another one, you know, a trash can, and all of a sudden, you know, we've got some rhythm going. But, yeah. but you know, that rhythm, you know, contributed to jazz. You know, if you look at the early influences of jazz, there were many influences that came from Cuba. And then the music of the 40s and 50s, you know, the cool thing to do was the Cuban music, you know, whether it was the mambo or the cha-cha or the rumba or the conga line, you know, that you probably have done at a wedding.
Right. You know, I didn't know those came from Cuba.
All of those things, you know, I mean, it was like the thing, you know, before like the British invasion and so forth in the 60s, you know, the cool thing was the Cuban music. And we're proud of that influence from the African culture, the mixture with the Spanish culture and the, you know, the guitar and the, you know, the flamenco type music that came from Spain. But all of those blending in into what I think is a success in Cuba, even the humor, and that's part of the sad situation that I think helped us, that humor, to be able to laugh at ourselves and situation, I think has helped us to integrate here. But it also is one of the causes why Cuba is still under communism, because, you know what, the family concept, the humor of making light of something that's terrible, you know, that's part of the survival. And now, of course, you know, some of it comes from some of those basic Christian principles of, I think that we were talking about a little bit earlier off this video, but just the, you know, the importance of humility, gratitude, and forgiveness. I think that those are concepts that come from the Christian faith, you know, and of course, you know, being a Catholic from the Catholic faith, that I think are crucial to stopping that invasion of hatred and discourse that comes from some of those populist politicians and politics.
I absolutely love what you just said about humor and everything and the ability to laugh. I mean, on a more scientific note, I guess, I was just sitting in on the psychology-based meeting on Zoom the other day, and the head guy was saying that a lot of healing from your trauma, actually, and from things that go wrong in your life, a lot of healing can come from your ability to laugh at the situation. And you think about a funeral or something like that, or something terrible when everyone's grieving. It is psychological that when someone makes a joke and makes you laugh, your dopamine spikes.
Yeah.
You feel so much better. Yeah. And I even think of from a Catholic perspective, my middle name is Lorenzo, Paul Lorenzo Garcia. Mm-hmm. Saint Lorenzo was, it's such a funny story. My grandpa's name was Lorenzo. He was a funny guy. My other grandpa as well. My mom always loved to tell me, like, Saint Lorenzo was a patron saint of comedians.
Really?
And he was actually, yeah, it's great. And he was burned alive, actually. He was more or less grilled. They kind of put him in this contraption, a cage over a fire. And the story goes, yeah, crazy stuff back in the day. The story goes that he was being roasted on his back, and they said something like, do you renounce God or something? They were waiting for him to say that. And he said, turn me over. I'm done on this side.
Oh, and goodness, yeah.
Wow, yeah. Holy cow. Talk about humor in the face of adversity.
Yeah.
And again, just to tie it all back, humor is huge.
We are brought to you by Forest Edge Tree Service. If you have trees or tree stumps on your property that you want gone, go nowhere else but Livingston County's premier tree service provider, Forest Edge Tree Service. Your yard is no place for looming, dead, or damaged trees. It's just a matter of time before they come down, ruining your property, ruining your week, and ruining your bank account. This is exactly why you need to be a responsible adult and hire the services of Forest Edge Tree Service. Simply give Joe Rudin a call or a text at 815-615-3037 to get a free quote today. Forest Edge Tree Service is staffed with trained professionals who use cutting-edge equipment to get the job done right every time. Their cleanup is top-notch, they're fully insured, and their customers are always pleased with the jobs that they do, which is why they've earned a reputation of being Livingston County's premier tree service provider. So keep your family, pets, vehicles, and neighbors safe, and save yourself from a world of headaches when you call or text Forest Edge Tree Service to get those dangerous, looming, troublesome trees off of your property. That's Forest Edge Tree Service, Livingston County's premier tree service provider.
When the United States was coming over to Cuba to pick up kids, to pick up anyone in boats, take them over here, is it correct that, I forget what the operation was called, was a name, but
that was much later than when I came. So what was happening was that, you know, all of these people were leaving Cuba, which was an embarrassment for Castro.
Oh, of course.
So, and things were so bad at one point in time in the 1980 that there were 10,000 people that were around the embassy, the Peruvian embassy, and they knocked down the fence and were able to get into the embassy property. And of course, when you get into an embassy property, that's like land that is protected. So the Cuban military could not go in and get these people. But of course, Peru couldn't do anything with 10,000, you know, people all of a sudden at their embassy. So Jimmy Carter said, you know, after people approached him and so forth, he said, well, you know, the U.S. would take those 10,000 as immigrants. You know, you can send them to the United States, you know, and asked Castro if he was willing to do that. And Castro very cleverly said, yes, you know, those people, we don't want them. They want to leave. They can go. However, there are other people that want to leave here also. Maybe this is an opportunity to for them. You know, if they don't want to be here, we want to get rid of them, was his public image. But what he actually did was that yes, he allowed some of those people whose relatives rented boats or had boats and came to pick up their relatives in Cuba. And there were some people that did that. But what Castro did was he took a lot of prisoners that he wanted to get rid of, and people from mental institutions, a lot of, you know, back in the at that point in time, AIDS was a real something that was really a huge thing that was not easily solved in the world. And he put a bunch of the AIDS patients he had at different hospitals. He put all of those people on those boats that relatives sent over to Cuba to pick up their own. So all of a sudden, you know, the Cuban image, you know, changes from these people that have been just so grossly successful.
Right.
To all of a sudden, you know, these criminals, you know, that are, hey, those are Cubans. So he, Castro, tarnished the reputation of Cubans with that particular act. And most of those people, you know, were just, a lot of them were kept in jail or in institutions or sent, you know, I don't know how many were sent back to Cuba. But, you know, it was a problem that it embarrassed Jimmy Carter, embarrassed the U.S. government, mm-hmm. embarrassed the Cuban immigrants here. So it was a real move, smart move on Castro, a cruel but smart move on him, on his part. And that happened in 1980. And that was the boat lift, you know, it's called, but I forget what exactly it's called, but it's the boat lift of 1980.
Wow. Yeah. He was trying to sabotage what had up to that point been an incredible group of immigrants from Cuba.
Right.
He was trying to sabotage their image.
Yeah. Now, of course, we were humility is important, but we're also at the same time, you know, proud of mm-hmm. our hard work and grateful for what we've been able to accomplish. And so that's a minority. And even, you know, a lot of those people were just, a lot of the people that came out were also just good people that have likewise done. Mm-hmm. Done very well. So, you know, that's that story.
And so I just want to ask, and I know you're a big guy on the importance of being humble, limiting your pride, but just for the sake of the audience to know what, and maybe immigrants themselves that are listening to this episode, could you say, like, what was your career progression out of the orphanage? Because you ended up creating a pretty decent life for yourself. What is it that you ended up doing after the orphanage?
Well, I think, you know, kind of a funny story. I my brothers, when I was in that private Catholic school, my brothers were just so good. I mean, they were like the untouchables. You know, one of them was like one of the highest, you know, academically in this school that went all the way from, you know, kindergarten to high school. And then the other one was, you know, did well in academically and was, you know, good in sports. He was a, you know, good looking, charming guy, you know, and it was tough to compete as a kid. So mm-hmm. for a while, I really didn't pay a lot of attention to academics as a little kid in, like, you know, third grade and stuff. And my focus was more on trying to stop bullies from bullying other kids. So I would get in trouble, but I
love that. That's pretty cool.
But the funny thing was that I would get punished, and part of the punishment might be to copy a page of the dictionary, or, you know, what are all the capitals of Europe, or, you know, some other thing that was a way of teaching me something, you know, kind of by force after school. And so I learned all kinds of stuff from that. So ironically, even though I wasn't really forced, really focused on academics, I learned a lot of things. And then when I went to the orphanage, I realized, you know, I know a lot of this stuff. So I kind of took an interest in school. And so just over time, and of course, I was working, like I said, from the time that I was 12. In high school, I probably was working close to 30 hours a week outside of school. But I became, you know, an honor student. I graduated 56, I think, out of like 1,100 graduating class.
Oh, my word.
I had an offer to go to Stanford. I didn't go to Stanford. I had a full ride at a university in Colorado. Mm-hmm. But my brothers, like I said, they all graduated from college, became, you know, managers in different organizations, one in IT, the other one working for United Airlines, very successful for many years. And I became a CPA. I wanted to, when I was in high school, I wanted to either work for the United Nations, you know, kind of helping, fighting poverty and saving the world, you know, mm-hmm. as a kind of a, was one of my dreams. Or I loved the ocean. So I either that or marine biology. Mm-hmm. And this dean from the school that ultimately gave me the scholarship, he was the dean from the accounting school, and I told him how I love languages and travel, and he said, well, you know, accounting is the language of the world. I mean, accounting is the language of business. Mm-hmm. And he says, and you can see the world with that. And then whether a company is starting or where the company is closing. You know, the first ones to hire are an accountant. The last ones that you let go are the accountants.
Right.
And so he encouraged me to go into accounting, and I became a CPA. And I worked for a large international firm. And then I became a controller, a CFO at one time for a corporation. I was an auditor. For many years, an internal auditor for, you know, multi-billion dollar companies. You know, they send me all over the world, you know, so they paid me to these almost 40 countries that I visited. Yeah. I was paid to go there because of some of my language skills and, you know, my educational and experience in accounting and finance. Mm-hmm. And I had important lead roles in Latin America and in Spain and Europe. And that was my story.
Me some of the names of these corporations that you were an auditor for, and they're humongous organizations. It's very impressive. And again, I don't want to make
these
you
are
deal.
These are Fortune 500 companies. I was very lucky to work with. They were very good, very mm-hmm. good companies, and they were good to me. And my brothers had a similar story, and really there are many Cubans that have had similar stories where it's just the expectation that somehow just gets communicated to us that, you know, you need to work hard in school and you need to work hard, period. I think I definitely followed that American dream, and I'm very grateful for that.
So inspiring, man. So inspiring. And
thank you.
Just so we know, what is the current state then of Cuba today? Is it much like it was then, or has it drastically changed for the better? I don't know if a whole lot of people know that off the top of their head.
Yeah, now, sadly, you know, Cuba went from having one of the highest standards of living, like I said, in the 50s when I was a child. You know, the Cuban peso traded like the American dollar. Cuba had, you know, probably in the top three countries in the world, I mean, in Latin America, as far as the standard of living. So it went from that having one of the highest to now being, I think Haiti is the only one that's, you know, poorer than Cuba in that Latin America part of the world, or really on the Western Hemisphere.
Man.
So it's not doing well. And then now the Castro brothers have died. So there is an opportunity, hopefully, for some change. But it's a sad situation now. And I don't know. I pray that there'll be some change. There's a huge opportunity. You know, one of the things that I want to say to make sure that I'm not biased. When all those doctors and other people left, you know, Cuba had a severe need for doctors, and they really focused on creating doctors. And one of the few positive things that Castro has done is that there are so many doctors that one of his exports are sending doctors. For example, when I was traveling in Latin America, I met Cuban doctors that were sent there. Because what happens is they send them there and then they get a salary and they have to send most of that salary back to Cuba. Mm. And the government keeps the majority of it. But, you know, it's a way to have a better standard of living. Like the average person in Cuba makes something like, I think it's like $58 a month.
Oh my.
You know, imagine there are many of those doctors in Cuba that on the side, you know, because they also, you know, don't make, you know, much more than that. That on the side, they'll get their car, they'll turn their car into a taxi and drive tourists around or mm-hmm. what have you, because it's that extreme.
That is extreme. Wow.
So the people continue to try to leave Cuba. There was one, I'll have to show you the picture offline of this one Cuban that was so inventive. He turned a car into a boat. Now, sadly, that guy got caught by the United States Coast Guard. The rule now is if you don't land on the U.S., you're sent back. You know, so if they catch you in the open seas, they have to send you back. So they sent this guy that had done that, which like is an engineering feat to mm-hmm. to turn like a 53 Buick into a boat.
Right.
And they sent him back, and then, you know, they threw him in prison. When he got out of prison, he did it again. and I forget, I think he may have made it the second time, but yeah, I'll have to show you the picture.
Well, man, this has been such a great conversation. Your story is extremely inspiring, Orlando. And I mean, this is going to be educational for everyone. And this should just go to show that for those of us, there's a growing number of college kids that think that communism might be the way. This just goes to show it's really not. And America is a pretty, pretty great place, wouldn't you say?
I absolutely agree with that. You know, it just, part of what communism does is that it erodes incentive. So, you know, the human nature, you know, you have to realize that there are some that are more active, aggressive, energetic than others. Hmm. And no, you cannot force people to just everybody be the same. And in reality, that's a farce, because even in communism, you know, you have the people, you have the majority of the people, which is like the, let's say 95%. And then you have the small percentage that are government type people. And then you have the top government people. All of those are gross different classes. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happens. And then when you throw everybody into that 95%, you're all the same, you're all poor. It takes away incentive. Mm-hmm. Why should I work hard when no matter what it is that I do, I'm going to get the same
as simple as that.
As you. And that's the sad thing. You know, at one point in time, even myself, you know, I was thinking, you know, there's something to where we're all the same. But, you know, over time you realize, you know, we should all be treated as equals in terms of justice and so forth. But you have to realize that we're all different. You have some strengths that I don't. I have some strengths that you don't. And, you know, we need to reward excellence and hard work. And so that's something that doesn't happen under communism as it should. And it's one of the failures of communism.
Wonderfully put there, Orlando. Your story, as I said, is great. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on today. It really was great.
Thank you. Sorry for if I went off on some tangents, but it's been my pleasure, Paul. You take care. All the best.
Thank you.
All right. That is a wrap. Wow.
And that's a wrap. Thank you so much for listening to that episode of The Paul Garcia Show. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it on Facebook or with your friends. And if you haven't already, like this page on Facebook and subscribe on YouTube. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave this show a 5-star rating and an honest review. If you'd like to support The Paul Garcia Show, you can do so by donating any dollar amount on Venmo to The Paul Garcia Show. Additionally, if you'd like to become a monthly donor and gain access to exclusive bonus footage, you can do so on patreon.com/Paul Garcia. Until next Sunday, thanks for listening and watching. I'm Paul Garcia. God bless and have a great week.